I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. Today on the show, a growing population of young Marylanders between 14 and 25 lack a fixed, regular residence and are not in the custody of a parent or guardian. State education officials identified more than 14,000 homeless students during a recent school year. Ingrid Lofgren of the Homeless Persons Representation Project tells us about a state-funded census of homeless teenagers and young adults. We'll also hear different views about the recent Supreme Court ruling on money and politics and how it might affect state elections. We get the latest restaurant news and reviews from The Sun's critic, Richard Gorelick. And we'll talk about gardening for the dinner table with Susan Reimer, Nancy Taylor Robeson, and Donna Crivello. Midday Friday starts after the news from NPR. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. It's Midday Friday. Thanks for joining us. We have a busy couple of hours ahead. After the news at 1, it's our annual spring gardening hour, and this time we'll emphasize growing your own. We'll have something for those of you who've gardened before, and a special emphasis for those of you who've decided it's time to get personally involved in the local food movement, and it doesn't get more local than growing your own in your own backyard. My colleague from The Sun, Susan Reimer, will be here, along with another master gardener and writer, Nancy Taylor Robeson. They'll talk about planting and growing. And then Donna Crivello of Donna's Cafes in Baltimore comes along to tell us how to cook those fresh veggies from the backyard. That's after the news at 1. Between now and then, Richard Gorelick, the restaurant critic of The Sun, joins us, and we'll have a discussion about the ramifications for Maryland, from the recent Supreme Court ruling on money and political campaigns. So all that's between now and the end of this hour. We start off the noon hour with a look at a disturbing trend in Maryland and what the state plans to do about it. A growing population of young Marylanders between 14 and 25 years of age lack a fixed, regular residence and are not in the custody of a parent or guardian. They are homeless. State education officials identified more than 14,000 homeless students during the 2011-2012 school year. Ingrid Lofgren, a fellow with the Homeless Persons Representation Project, is here to tell us more about the problem and about an effort that will be made to account for homeless teenagers and young adults and assess their needs. So, Ingrid, welcome to the show. Nice to have you on Midday.
Thanks for having me.
First, let me ask you about that number, that 14,000 homeless students. That probably jumps out to a lot of our listeners here and saying, what? How can that be? What explains that 14,000? And how is that accounted for?
So 14,000 homeless students were identified in public schools statewide, as you said, during the 2011-12 school year. That number is based on self-identification by students or on the observations of guidance counselors, teachers, and homeless education liaisons. About 1,000 of those students are homeless on their own, not living with a parent or guardian. The rest may be homeless in their families. We know that this is an undercount. Young people often seek to avoid detection because of fear of being drawn into the child welfare system or being exploited in various ways. So although that is a staggering number, I would submit that it's probably a dramatic undercount.
I know there are probably many reasons, but generally, how do so many teenagers and young adults become homeless? Let's talk about the reasons.
So systemic factors like poverty and lack of affordable housing are certainly relevant for young people as they are for the homeless population generally. But a key difference for youth and young adults who are unaccompanied and homeless is family breakdown and systems failure, really. Many young people become homeless because of conflict or abuse in their home, death or incarceration of a caregiver, or because they're rejected by their families because of pregnancy or often because of sexual orientation or gender identity or expression. And then also young people who do end up in our child welfare system or the juvenile justice system are at extremely high risk of homelessness when they exit those systems without the skills and resources and permanent connections that they need to live stably as adults.
Or even to have the support when they come out of those institutions or whatever the form of incarceration is.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's why you mentioned an age range that goes up to 25. It includes young adults. And that's largely because young people at that transition age in Maryland, you can stay in the foster care system until 21. After they age out, they're over 18, they're young adults, but they still really need support to transition to adulthood.
I noticed that there was a full-page ad in last Sunday's New York Times taken out by a nonprofit imploring Pope Francis to protect LGBT youth from rejection by their families, a rejection that the ad said is based often on religious grounds. This ad says some 200,000 LGBT youth experienced homelessness this past year, and that LGBT youth make up about 40% of the homeless youth in the United States. And is that what you're seeing in Maryland? I mean, you mentioned it a moment ago, but that you're seeing that trend too.
Anecdotally, yes. But unfortunately, we really aren't collecting any demographic data, and largely we're not counting homeless youth at all. So we really don't know for sure. And it's critical that we start to do that so that we can tailor our responses to the needs of young people. For example, if there is a serious need for family support work and family acceptance work, which I believe that there is, we need to know that. We need to direct resources in that way. And also, you know, the Ali Fournet Center, the nonprofit that you
mentioned.
That's
the one that took out the ad, yeah.
Exactly. They provide services specifically for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender homeless youth. We don't have those LGBT-specific services for young people in Maryland. We need them. We need housing for young people who identify as LGBT, places where they really feel safe and can come forward and get the care that they need, because they, all homeless youth, are very high risk for victimization, exploitation, all sorts of harms and challenges while they're homeless. LGBT youth are at exponentially higher risk for sexual assault, human trafficking. The list goes on and on. So we have to find these young people and make them safe.
For young people who are still children, who are minors, or 15, 16, 17 years old and are homeless, maybe not in school at all, maybe just out there somewhere, is there any agency that's responsible for finding them, bringing them in? Is the school system in the city or any of the counties?
Schools, because of federal funding and federal law, are required to report on the number of homeless students, but they're not required to go out and find young people who are homeless and may or may not be attending school. And also, our Department of Human Resources is only responsible for young people who are in the child welfare system or for whom reports of abuse or neglect have been made.
Mm-hmm.
So this group of children, as you said, and young people really fall in this gray area. And I think that's what our state has started to recognize. Our legislators, our agencies have started to pay more attention to this and realize that we need to do something about that.
Okay, let's go over that then, Ingrid. There was a task force report. I had a copy of it sent to me this week by a woman named Ingrid Lofgren. It was ordered up by the General Assembly in 2013, this report. What were its recommendations?
The task force made a number of recommendations, I think something like 73 concrete action steps that could be taken to prevent and end youth homelessness in Maryland. They were divided into several categories, including the need to identify homeless youth and connect them with services, needs related to housing, education, economic stability, and leadership among state agencies and our branches of government.
So what's going to happen now? You went down to the General Assembly. You had an idea about how to get this thing started. I referred to it as a census, so to speak, sort of a census, a way of accounting for these homeless young people, young adults and teenagers.
So one of several bills that passed this General Assembly that implements recommendations of the task force that you mentioned is a bill that creates the Maryland Unaccompanied Homeless Youth and Young Adult Count Demonstration Project.
Wow.
It's a mouthful.
She did that from memory, folks, too, not looking at the notes. It's very good.
And it's exactly what you said. It's a census.
Mm-hmm.
It responds to our need for data in order to understand who unaccompanied homeless youth are, what their needs are, and how many there are. It's based on a federal initiative called Youth Count, and it will involve counting homeless youth in 6 Maryland regions. It will involve qualitative surveying.
How do you do that? I mean, you're actually going to go out into the street with clipboards? What's going to be done?
Absolutely. There is a street count component. This is something that communities are used to doing because it's a requirement for local jurisdictions that get funding from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. So this builds on a youth-specific component. So there will be youth outreach workers, for example. It also involves a service provider count. So shelters, anyone who provides services to people who are homeless, including youth, will report on the number of people they served at a certain point
in time.
And their ages, right? And what we're also building on with this effort is qualitative surveying, so we understand more about the demographics and the experiences and the needs of young people who are homeless on their own.
It seems like there's something missing here. I mean, I understand what you're doing, getting an accounting, first of all, but in terms of the services that are provided in the state, I said, you know, is there an agency that actually goes out and tries to find homeless children who are not accounted for, who say should be in school and aren't in school, who don't seem to have a permanent home in the view of the teachers or principals at a school who might notice these trends that, you know, that they're what? Living in a car someplace, or they hear a rumor that someone's actually living in an abandoned house and they're 16 or 17 years old. It seems like there's something missing here. Is this something for the Department of Social Services?
Yes, it is. And they were part of the task force that we talked about. Mm-hmm. And I think they have interest in doing more in this area. They introduced a bill this session to implement a task force recommendation that reconvenes and reestablishes the governor's Interagency Council on Homelessness. They're going to use that body to continue to work towards developing strategies to address this problem. So I hope they will do more, and I think the will is there.
Some money came from the legislature to get this count started, this demonstration project.
Yes, I'm very pleased that Governor O'Malley funded the demonstration project to the tune of $200,000 in his 2015 supplemental budget. And that was in response to a request from Delegate Mary Washington from our own 43rd District in Baltimore City, who has been an amazing champion on this issue and served on the task force along with Senator Ed Riley, a Republican senator from Anne Arundel County, and introduced several bills this session focused on youth homelessness.
It seemed like this task force report was really key to getting them moving on that.
It was. I think it opened people's eyes and provided a lot of information.
So when do you get started, Ingrid? I mean, are you going to do it, meaning the Homeless Persons Representation Project, or how will this be done? Who will be doing it?
We'll certainly support however we can, but this effort will be initiated by the Department of Housing and Community Development. They will issue a request for proposals for a coordinating entity that will oversee the collection, and then there will be a need for broad community engagement in all of the areas where the count will take place.
Well, thanks for coming in to talk about this, Ingrid, and letting more people know about what the problem is, but also what's being done about it. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ingrid Lofgren is a Skadden Fellow and attorney at the Homeless Persons Representation Project right here in Baltimore. We're going to take a break on Midday Friday. When we come back, how a landmark Supreme Court ruling could affect Maryland political campaigns and the outcomes of elections. Please stay with us. And this is Midday Friday. Dan Rodericks here. A week ago, Maryland election officials said they will no longer enforce a state law that imposes an overall limit of $10,000 on campaign contributions by an individual in a 4-year election cycle. A donor will still be limited to contributing no more than $4,000 to a particular candidate during an election cycle. But donors are now free to give $4,000 to as many candidates as desired. This decision followed a landmark ruling by the Supreme Court of the United States, the so-called McCutcheon ruling, that aggregate contribution limits are invalid under the First Amendment. That meant Maryland's law limiting such contributions to $10,000 cannot be enforced, so saith the Maryland State Board of Elections. What does that mean for campaigns and elections in Maryland? Here to discuss it are Jennifer Bevendangle, Director of Common Cause in Maryland, the government watchdog group. Jennifer, nice to have you with us.
Nice to be here.
And Baltimore County businessman Bruce Robinson from Basic Sound Business Services in Overly. But Bruce is here because he was a member of a 17-member state commission to study campaign finance law. Bruce, nice to have you with us, too.
Thank you, Dan. Good to be here.
First, let me ask Jennifer a little bit about the McCutcheon ruling itself, go back to the Supreme Court. Then we'll talk a little bit about Maryland. Not too happy with this decision.
We're very concerned about this decision. At the federal level, it'll certainly open doors to some very large donors having an undue influence in the process. But as you can see, we're already seeing very immediate effects in Maryland with the State Board of Elections saying we have to get rid of our caps, too. I think the impact in Maryland will be far worse than what we'll see even at the national level.
Just a little bit more on the aggregate business for people to understand. I think I've explained it here pretty well, but basically in a four-year election cycle, one person can give a total of $10,000 to as many candidates as they wish.
Well, the individual cap still holds.
You're
limited to 4,000 to any individual person. But yes, you can now give to every single delegate, every single senator, all the county council contendants you want.
Up to 4,000.
All the slates you want, every PAC that you want. Whereas before, you got to $10,000 pretty quickly and you were done.
Right.
So drastically increasing the amount of money we anticipate seeing spent in Maryland elections.
Personally, I wouldn't have got there very quickly, Jennifer, because I give $2 here. Actually, I don't give it all because I have my job at the newspaper. But anyway, so Bruce Robinson, let me hear from you. First of all, let me ask you about the commission you sat on, if you don't mind.
Sure.
This is a 17-member state commission to study campaign finance law. Did the commission actually make this recommendation to the Board of Elections after McCutcheon?
The commission met before McCutcheon.
Before McCutcheon.
Right.
Had it made a recommendation about this?
The focus of the commission was more on Citizens United and the great evils that would come from that.
The other Supreme Court ruling from 2010. Okay, what is your personal feeling about what's happened here? First, the McCutcheon ruling, and now as it impacts Maryland.
I agree with the court's finding in this. I lean more toward Justice Thomas' decision where he added that some of those campaign finance laws that were eviscerated to a degree should be gotten rid of completely. They should have been overruled. And I agree with him on that.
You think this is a form of expression, giving money to political campaigns?
Absolutely. And money in political campaigns is a tradition that goes back to the 1700s. No one was asking who funded George Washington or Madison.
Right, but we had in the United States a progressive movement in the early 20th century where the idea came along, Jennifer, that to put limits on how much money could influence politics and whether companies, corporations could give donations as well. So maybe you could explain for our listeners the rationale, the whole idea about putting in limits.
The limits assure that everybody's voice is equal in the system. We're creating a system where candidates first go to the wealthy individuals to even determine who can run, and then the voters get to select who among those anointed few they would like to vote for. And that undermines democracy because there shouldn't be gatekeepers in the democracy that prejudge who should even be on your ballot when you come up to vote.
Prejudge, meaning the gatekeepers, meaning the people with money.
Yes.
That's what you mean.
The cost of campaigns is skyrocketing. In Maryland, we've seen it go up tenfold, gubernatorial races, just between the mid-90s and then the mid-2000s. With that amount of money needed to run, you can't even get your name out there without these wealthy individuals now anointing you and sending you forth with their backing. And so we have to change that system, both to make sure that all different types of candidates have the opportunity to be a member of this democracy, but then also to make sure that citizens feel their voice matters more than just as a final checkoff.
But what do you do now, Jennifer, given Citizens United, given this ruling in McCutcheon? It seems like the Supreme Court is saying it's all going to go away. All these limitations should go away because giving to campaigns is a form of protected under the First Amendment.
Certainly, we need to be working at the federal level to have a constitutional amendment that would clarify that this is a limited speech, right? Just like shouting fire in a crowded building isn't allowed, donating endless amounts of money into your political system has the same kind of troubling impacts on society. But here in Maryland, in the short term, there's two important steps we can take. The first is reporting, making sure that if individuals are giving massive amounts of money, that every citizen has the ability to find out who they are, why they're giving, and who they're giving it to.
Within 24 hours?
Within 24, maybe 48 hours. And then the second step is public funding of elections, which would allow citizens' donations, small dollar donations, to be matched and leveraged so that they become more like a major donor in the system.
Bruce Robinson, I'll go back to you. Did you ever at any point accept the idea of limitations on campaign donations, even going back to when you first got interested in politics?
Yes. Individual donation limitations are reasonable ways for our society to control the actual corruption that can occur.
So you think the $4,000 limit in Maryland is still a good idea?
It's a reasonable limit. The commission recommended higher limitations to keep up with inflation that's been going on since the 20 years since that limit was set. Even during the commission hearings, I suggested indexing those on a four-year cycle to determine what inflation was and set a new limit for the next four-year cycle. That wasn't adopted. It was just a recommendation.
Right. But beyond that, you say this idea of limiting aggregate donations, limiting someone to $10,000 in a four-year cycle, you think that's a limit too far?
I do. Those people who wish to, who have those resources and would like to contribute them, should be given the opportunity to have their speech heard. We're cutting them off because they have money, and that seems like a very unconstitutional thing to do to them just because they have the money to make that contribution. People without money have many, many other ways of contributing to campaigns, whether they knock on doors, put signs up, lick envelopes, do mailings, talk to their friends, have barbecues in their backyard to help their candidate. That's what's within their means, whereas the head of a multi-corporate conglomerate organization spends their time making their money, and they can contribute cash.
But most people don't have that kind of money, Bruce. I mean, there's a good number of people who have that kind of money, but most of society, most of the people who line up at polling places on election day don't come anywhere near being able to make those kind of donations. So to Jennifer's point about there being these gatekeepers, you know, the people with the money and the influence to sort of set the whole agenda for an election cycle, for who's going to run for a congressional district in the next 2 years? Who's going to run for governor or attorney general? You don't buy that that's too much influence for one strata of society?
I think money has always been seen as a tool for evaluating whether or not a particular candidate has support in their community, how much money they can raise. By limiting the contribution that an individual can make, then the person who raises a lot of money is getting it from a lot of people, even though they're not getting a lot of $25 contributions and building their million off of $25. They're still generating the support of influential people, important people in their community, people who probably own companies, hire people, employ a lot of people. Those are the people who may have that kind of money.
So a candidate may know like 12 millionaires. But if as long as the limitation is $4,000 on each millionaire, you're saying, well, then the influence is limited.
I think it is. And I don't think that there's many people in the country or in Maryland like McCutcheon who gave to 16 candidates, maxed out to them, wanted to give to 12 more candidates, and also wanted to give to some political committees. There are some people in the country like that. We're not populated with a lot of those people who want to be that active with that many dollars. There are a few. And the largest contributors are not individuals, but they're organizations.
Let me go back to Jennifer Bevendangle, the director of Common Cause in Maryland. The other voice you just heard, Bruce Robinson, who served on a 17-member state commission to study campaign finance law here in Maryland. So what about that? Let's pick through that a little bit, Jennifer. Having the $4,000 individual limitation still in place, even though the aggregate control is gone now.
One of the fears is that what we're going to see is, instead of super PACs, bunches of people with lots of money who got together to spend on campaigns independently, we're going to see super donors, groups of people with a common interest who come together and pool their resources so that they can each max out to very targeted candidates. And before, when you had these aggregate limits, a major donor had to choose, and they're going to invest in the races that meant the most to them. Now you could have someone just donating across the board to as many races for very just purely political reasons or issue reasons that take that candidate away from what might matter in his or her district. It takes him or her away from the constituents because you're seeing this money launching candidates who otherwise wouldn't have had the ability to even run. And that's one of the concerns where you say, well, you know, they have to raise money anyway. But if they're raising money from their constituents, it's a very different candidacy than if they're raising money from donors who have very different reasons to give.
We have time to take some phone calls in this segment of Midday Friday. If you'd like to weigh in, give us your opinion about the McCutcheon ruling and also the decision by the Maryland State Board of Elections to follow the Supreme Court on this, to say that they will no longer enforce the Maryland law that imposes an overall limit of $10,000 on campaign contributions by an individual in a four-year election cycle. As we pointed out here, the $4,000 limitation of a contribution to a particular candidate during an election cycle is still in place. Now, one thing we may see as a result of this, right, is that campaigns that previously did not see this kind of money may start seeing this kind of money. And I'm talking about races for House of Delegates, for instance, state senator, even maybe comptroller, I don't know. But the local races and the district races, that's where we might see some impact, it seems to me.
I think that's where we'll see the biggest increase in the cost to run. And that raises several concerns. Before, if you were a large donor, you probably gave to the speaker or the Senate president, probably the governor, and you were fairly close to maxed out. Now, you'll just keep going down the ballot and down the ballot. And while that creates opportunities for delegates maybe in less prioritized districts to get some money, it also enables those races to cost just exponentially more money. And that narrows the field of who is even willing to run. A lot of evidence has shown that women candidates, Latina candidates, a lot of minority candidates, even school teachers, firefighters, it's increasingly more and more difficult for them to even contemplate running for office because they think, well, how could I raise $70,000 or $90,000 for a Senate seat? Well, if the cost of a delegate race becomes $200,000, that's going to shut the door even more firmly. And that's a very big concern.
410-662-8780. Again, is our phone number if you'd like to join our conversation here. So, Bruce, what about that on the state races? We see the kind of influence of money that we hadn't seen before.
Well, there are lots of issues in there that I will touch on. People from who would like to run, and they're from groups that are traditionally underfunded, are now able to get more funding because it's not that there's no money in the Hispanic community to support candidates or no money to support women. It's that those people who were donating were limited into how much they could contribute in a given race. They're going to go to power. They're not going to try and support someone who might make changes. The money is still out there. The people that have that money that might make a contribution are using the money in other ways to influence that election, whether they do it through independent activity, through advertising, parties, independent events. That money is still being active. Now it's bringing that money out of the background, putting it up front in the candidate account where there is reporting and where there's accountability for where the candidate came from.
Jennifer, what about that?
Reporting is one of those short-term solutions that we hope the state will act on very quickly. There's a lot of ways to still funnel money without knowing where it went. Slates are a big issue where a group of candidates, they don't even have to be on the ballot together, get together and decide to pool their resources. There's no knowing which candidates that money was spent on or how it was spent. So we absolutely need to make sure there's transparency there. And there's also a lot of concern that the current reporting system, when it's not an election year, candidates report once a year who gave them money. So we're going to have to look at that type of requirement and make sure it's incredibly strong, 48-hour notice, perhaps,
I think you both agree on that one. Then.
I agree completely.
The need for transparency and quickly so people know. Bruce, you said on the commission, this commission to study campaign finance law was put together by the governor, the Speaker of the House, the President of the Senate, right?
Right. It was a joint resolution, and it called for each of those three to now, appoint members.
You studied Citizens United and its possible impact in Maryland.
Yes.
Did the commission actually make any recommendations? And if not, I just wonder what the conversations were like, the deliberations.
The conversations were that Citizens United was going to bring untold evil down on the voters and the electoral system in Maryland. And I'm watching. I'm waiting. I'm looking for it.
Okay.
I haven't seen it.
All right. Did the commission make any recommendations?
Yes. They made recommendations to limit corporations. They spent a terrible long time on LLCs and how to limit contributions by LLCs, and those are often the ones that we're most worried about, mm-hmm. were the real estate developers who create an LLC for every piece of property they buy, they own, and then the LLC would make a contribution to candidate A, but 100 LLCs could make that contribution, and they're all run by the same person. And the commission was concerned with that reasonably, because we're talking about one individual directing more money that leads to the corruption that we really want to avoid in politics. I mean, we want to trust that our candidates and that our elected officials are acting in the best interest. We know it's not going to always happen, but we want them to be in a position where we can look at that and hold them accountable for it.
Just a point of information, the recommendation to do away with the aggregate limit in Maryland, this is a decision of the Board of Elections, right? Not the
Correct.
Commission.
Right.
Right. Okay.
The commission would not have made that recommendation. The makeup of the commission
would commission
never...
The commission would have said keep the aggregate limit.
They said keep it and raise it.
Ah. Even despite McCutcheon.
Well, before McCutcheon.
They would have said that before the McCutcheon.
Before McCutcheon.
So once McCutcheon came, that's the end of that.
And they wanted to raise it to make it more reasonable.
Let's get a quick call in here. Michael in Gardenville, thank you for calling Midday Friday.
Hi, Dan. I just wanted to say that I kind of resent the notion that Mr. Robinson said that people without much money could always go door-to-door and kind of aggregate their resources in order to have as much power as wealthy people do, and that wealthy people were running their corporations or their empires or whatever. They didn't have time to do that. But he doesn't seem to realize that people who are just making a living wage, you know, working one or two jobs, and then they're going to have to go out and do all of this, while the wealthy people get to put people in that they who agree with them, and then they write the laws. I mean, it just doesn't seem to make sense.
Bruce, you want to respond to that?
Well, yes. What I was saying about the individual who doesn't have cash resources can work in other ways, not necessarily raising money, but working for the candidate of their choice to get their friends, their neighbors to understand why that's a good candidate, mm-hmm. not through the use of money, but by generating that one thing that money doesn't absolutely generate, votes. Get individuals who will vote for you and for your candidate.
For this election cycle that we're in, Jennifer, I mean, can anything be done in terms of the reporting you talked about, that quick reporting? That you need an act of the legislature to get something like that done?
Exactly. We need the legislature to come back and fix this. And that's not going to happen before June and then before November. So this will be a real test. It's going to be the first election here since the Citizens United case, and it will be the first election here since the McCutcheon case. And it'll be very interesting to see how much money gets spent when those post-November reports start coming in.
So we have to wait till then? Aren't we going to see some reports between now and June even?
There will be. There'll be a series of reports before and after the primary and then before and after the general. So we'll start to get a sense of where this is headed.
Okay.
And hopefully it'll give the legislature a lot of ammunition to come back and fix this.
We're going to pick up on this topic again on the Thursday edition of Midday. The chairman of the commission that Bruce Robinson sat on, Bruce Marcus, will be here on Thursday, along with Emily Scar from Maryland Perg, and Andy Kroll from Mother Jones, who's done some reporting about the impact of McCutcheon and Citizens United on the national scale. So we'll be picking up this topic again. It's a pretty interesting and important topic. Jennifer Bevendangle is director of Common Cause Maryland, and Bruce Robinson, his business in Baltimore County is Basic Sound Business Services. He served on the 17-member state commission to study campaign finance law. We thank you both for being here. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan.
Another break on Midday. When we come back, Richard Gorelick joins us. The restaurant critic of the Baltimore Sun has some news from the regional dining season. Plus, he'll tell us about some new entries in the Sun's top restaurants list, which has just been published. Still ahead on Midday, it's our annual spring gardening hour with Master Gardeners Susan Reimer and Nancy Taylor Robeson. This time, an emphasis on growing good things to eat, your personal farm-to-fork effort. how to grow your own in your own backyard. And then Chef Donna Crivello suggests what to do with the fruits or veggies of your labors. Midday in the Garden, after the news at 1. And welcome back to Midday. My colleague from the Baltimore Sun, Richard Gorelick, is here, the restaurant critic of the Sun. And there's always lots of things to talk about. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon, Dan.
Nice to see you. And Richard walked in with the magazine, which will be appearing in the Sunday Sun.
In your Sunday Sun.
This weekend, of Baltimore's 50 Best Restaurants.
That's right. It's a Baltimore Sun's 50 Best Restaurants. And we ranked them this year, which we did last year, too, come to think of it. And ranking is, gosh, it's so, it makes my brain fry. But, you know, it's, we have opinions, so we're sharing them. And, of course, our readers have opinions, too.
Right.
But we put ourselves in a line. So we rank them from 1 to 50. And I'll be really interested to hear what people have to say about
can
it.
Can I see it? Can I hold the magazine in my
hold
hand?
It.
And by the way, folks, if you go to the Dan Roderick's Facebook page, you can find a link to a very nice interactive spread of the Baltimore's top restaurants, 50 top restaurants at baltimoresun.com.
And I can say this because it wasn't I who did this. It is beautiful.
It is beautiful, isn't it?
The photography in this issue is just, I'm just so pleased to be associated with it.
I know.
I have my name in this magazine.
I agree with you. Even though we both work at the Sun, this is pretty good looking.
Well designed, and I'll stop shilling, but we have a, no, I won't, but we have a new online you can check out. It's already up online, the top 50. There's an interactive database that, you know, it looks so slick and beautiful.
Look at that. See, I just popped it up on the screen there. Look at that thing.
And gets you on a map.
All right.
And click and click and click. It's just gorgeous.
What I'd like to do, I mean, I'm going to mention some of these restaurants. They're very familiar to people. No surprise to a lot of people that Charleston came in number one, the Prime Rib number three, the Food Market in Hamden number two. Now, the Food Market's only been open for a few years, right?
The Food Market, here was my thinking about putting the Food Market that high. And it is a restaurant that Baltimore needed. And they are, the people over there at the Food Market are not out to show off. They're not out to teach you lessons about food. But their mission is to own and operate a restaurant that people have a great time in and great food in. And it's very simply that. So,
it's only in its second season, am I right? Maybe two or three years, two and a half or so.
And
yeah.
They're just so consistent, and I think there's something to be said, obviously, if I put it that high, but there's something to be said for, basically, a restaurant is in the business of entertaining people and feeding them delicious food, and they do that so consistently, and kind of modestly, too, that, yeah, I just put them up very high, and I'm happy with that.
Now, there's a couple others in here that don't surprise. Woodbury Kitchen, for instance, came in at number six, but I want to ask you about the two ahead of that, okay? Peter's Inn and Jack's Bistro. Could you start with Jack's Bistro, which came in at number five? This is over in Canton.
Jack's Bistro, I think, first came to attention when it opened for having unusual menu items like the macaroni and cheese with chocolate or the tuna fish or the tuna in gelatin. And I think that was a way for them to at least get talked about. But as it turns out, that's not, they're still doing that, but that's not what their bread and butter is. But their strong suit is just putting out delicious, interesting food. The owners of that restaurant, every year after January 1st, go to Asia. It's a different country every year, and whether it's Thailand or Vietnam, they come back so enthusiastic about sharing what they've learned on those trips.
What makes a bistro a bistro, and is this a bistro?
Gee, you know what? Sometimes I'll come across an article where people in France are wrangling with that, and they're gnashing their teeth, and they're complaining because the phrase or the word bistro has been diluted, and people are calling themselves bistro in this arrondissement or that. And a bistro originally, I think there's part of the origin of the word means quick, you know, like beat. And so bistro was compared to a cafe, someplace where you could stop and get a quick meal. Of course,
right.
Cafe, bistro, whatever sounds good, whatever goes well
with
your
pomfret and a steak. Pumphrey right. to a steak and a salad.
That would be a bistro now. Yep. Bistro was if your last name, so Roderick's Bistro sounds good.
Right.
Better than Gorelick's Cafe.
Okay.
Cafe
Garissa. So in the case of Jack's, maybe that doesn't matter so much?
Doesn't matter so much.
All right.
Oh, he got that name because Jack's Bistro, the name is funny. That was Jack Tripper on Three's Company when he opened his own restaurant in the last seasons of that show. He called it Jack's Bistro. So that was the inspiration for that.
Richard Gorelick, our guest in this segment of Midday Friday. He's the restaurant critic of the Baltimore Sun. We're talking about the Sun's 50 Best Restaurants issue that's coming out in print this Sunday with the Sunday Sun and is online now. Now, Peter's Inn in Fells Point.
Peter's Inn, you know, when I come here when I'm 80 years old and you're still here, I'll say, like, Peter's Inn. Like, that's everyone's favorite out-of-the-way restaurant that they like to share with friends. It's perennially, it's going to be that forever. But people are always taking their friends there and enchanting them with Peter's Inn, which has maybe a 7-item menu, maybe 5. There's some perennial items on that menu. Their steak is, I think the best steak in town. It's sometimes described as a former biker's bar, but it's long since shed that skin. It's just a charming Upper Fells Point neighborhood restaurant that delivers every time.
Richard, I don't want to give it all away. I just want to ask you about a few mm-hmm. more of these. Bottega, Charles North.
Bottega, man, you try to call them up and get a reservation because it is tricky. That is about a 15-seat restaurant, and it's BYOB. It's very special. It's if it was just one more, mason jar in there, you wouldn't go there because you think, oh, gosh, this is so weird and pretentious. But it's all honest, and that's another chalkboard menu. It changes every week. It's not for vegetarians, maybe, with some exceptions. It's meat-heavy and it's game-heavy. It is a very special place on a very unusual block of Maryland Avenue. And, call them up and make a reservation for a couple months from now. And,
1729 Maryland Avenue. And this sort of can be said for the food market. I'm sorry. The food market.
The food market.
Not easy to get a reservation.
Not easy, but Bottega's so small. 15 seats.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I see what you mean. So, Richard, let me ask you this. You said it's a daunting task trying to do a ranking. I mean, you can come up with the 50 best restaurants, but the ranking is the tough part.
It's tough. And listen, I hope it's not a cop-out for me to say that it's a conversation starter and we really want to hear what readers think, because it is our opinion and it is what we think. And we're not shy about our opinions either. But the thing, I guess, in the back of my mind sometimes is that you're ranking small businesses. And that's the hard part of it. It's not ranking movies or books, things that have already been produced by multi-million-dollar corporations. That's one thing. But in this case, in Baltimore, you're ranking people's lives and you're ranking their businesses. That's hard.
But you've caught 50. And if you can say that if you make the magazine, if you make the top 50 list, that's at least something. Right,
it's something, and if you didn't make the list, that might be because I haven't seen you for a while, and that is another concern too. I want to be sure that if you're in this magazine, that you belong here. So, if you call me today and wonder why you're not in the magazine, I might say, you know what, I need to come back and see what's up with your restaurant.
Okay. Now, what about surprises? I think maybe you've mentioned a couple here already. Are you surprised at how you ranked some of these? That in the past year, a new restaurant or fairly new restaurant impressed you, and you said, "Hey, you know, this might make top 10. This might at least make top 20 this year."
You were perceptive enough to sort of pick out the ones that I would have answered. Bottega to be I forget how high it was, but that sort of vaulted
it came
in there.
It came in at 10.
And that's big. I just think it's not a game changing restaurant, but I think it's. If I had people visiting from out of town, that might be the place I'd take them. And I was pleased, I'm always putting food market that high. I'm very sure of that decision, but I was pleased to see myself do that too. I so almost surprised myself by ranking it that high.
Number 13 on your list is a restaurant from Harbor East, Uzo Bay. And I distinctly remember reading your review of Uzo Bay and thinking, I've got to go there. Actually, it was one of those reviews that makes you really crave a certain dish.
I think sometimes I will think about a restaurant this way. I try to decide what it was they set out to do and how close they came to achieving what they did. And Uzo Bay set out to be a certain kind of restaurant. It set out to be a big, flashy is the wrong word, I don't want to say that, but a big, stylish restaurant, a night out type of restaurant, where you'd a special occasion place, and they achieved it. And I think not every restaurant needs to be that way, and certainly Jack's Bistro and Peter's Inn are not that muscular kind of restaurant. But Cunningham's and Towson is another restaurant that decided we want to be the kind of place where people come not only for a midweek meal, but for special occasions too. And we want to give them an atmosphere to luxuriate in, and they did it. And and then the food comes through too. People sometimes ask, what about the food? The food comes through too at all of these places.
And some of the places that I mentioned quickly at the beginning, you know, number one and number three, you can almost guess which restaurants in Baltimore might make your top 10 list, or probably going to make your top 10 list, right?
Yeah.
But there's something to be said for the consistency over the years of those restaurants. And it's tempting to try to look past them, right?
That's...
And say, well, do readers want to see the same list again that they might see in Baltimore Magazine, that they might see someplace else? But it's hard to look past certain restaurants.
It deserves everyone if I try to just mix it up like that. So the Prime Rib in the past has been my number one restaurant because in my head the phrase is nothing bad has ever happened at the Prime Rib. And if they dropped a tray of Crab Imperial on your coat, by the time you left, you'd be kissing them and say, I'll see you next week.
You'd have a new coat.
You'd have a new coat. Yeah. And
they'd send out for one. They'd take your measurements at the table and send out for one.
And to talk about consistency, that is the model of it.
Restaurant news or food news in Baltimore, a little bit of that. I saw your post yesterday about this new place in Remington called Parts and Labor, which is actually a butcher shop, right?
It's a dual purpose. It's in an old tire shop. It's run by the Jerdys, Spike and Amy Jerdy, who we know from Woodbury Kitchen. The butcher shop operation is open now. Their restaurant, the adjacent restaurant, will be open next week. I stopped there on the way here.
What was it like?
Oh, it is so beautiful. You feel so good in there.
Did you pick up something?
I did.
Or did you just look?
I did. I'm going back to get it on the way back.
All right. And so how many Jerdy places does that make now?
That is, we have Artifact Coffee, and we have Shoofly Diner, and now this. And, of course, Woodbury Kitchen.
Are you surprised Biroteca made your list at number 18?
That high or?
Yeah, no, just that it's there.
Yeah, Biroteca is another restaurant that when you step into it, you're already enjoying yourself. And then the food comes through for you too. But there's something very satisfying about the way that restaurant is managed and the regard that restaurant has for its customers. And I like that, too. I respond to that. I respond to restaurants.
So it's not just about beer.
No, it's not just about beer. I use a phrase in my head, are they ready for company? And I like that when you feel that they're ready. They're ready to serve you and ready to. Customer-focused places are important to me. Oh, I saw a photograph of one of my favorite places of the past year, the Other Corner Charcuterie Bar. Maybe I didn't see that, but
Corner?
We know the corner BYOB in Hamden opened up.
There it is. I see it. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they opened up
number 15.
That's for the corner BYOB, and now they have an adjacent bar next to itself. That's one of my favorite new places in Baltimore. It's called the Other Corner Charcuterie Bar.
Oh, I haven't noticed that yet. This is on 36th Street, right? You're saying it's adjacent to?
Adjacent, so you would enter on Elm. That is... that was one of the places, a few places I walked into where I had a profound sense of deja vu, as though I'd been there before and had been very happy there before. It's extremely charming.
I had a great plate of pasta at Grano again. The Little Grano?
Little Grano.
Little Grano.
Charming Grano.
Street,
Hamden
yeah.
is
yeah, it was really
the place
good.
Now.
Yeah. Richard Gorelick from The Sun, the restaurant critic. The results of their hard work, great photography, the 50 best restaurants in The Sun magazine in print. It's online now. Also, great interactive location there at BaltimoreSun.com. Take a look at that. You can go to my Facebook page and find a quick link to it. Well, thank you, Richard.
Thank you, and happy eating, everybody.
Yeah, thank you. Have a slice of Joe Squared pizza before you leave.
I intend to.
And then make sure you stop at Parts and Labor because you said you were going to pick up something on the way.
Thanks for the reminder.
Thank you very much. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in to the first hour of Midday. Stay tuned. The second hour of Midday Friday coming along. We're going to have a slice of Joe Squared pizza. Joe, thank you very much for providing lunch for our guests every Friday here on Midday. A short break for the news and then the second hour of our show.